Gresham College presents Designing for Humans by Harold Thimbleby, Gresham Professor of Geometry, with Dr. Anne Blandford of University College London.
Good evening and welcome to Gresham College. Gresham College is here in Barnard's Inn. Barnard's Inn Hall was talked about in Great Expectations, a book by Charles Dickens. I hope you all got Great Expectations. Evening. We're going to talk about designing for humans. We've had a series of lectures in this geometry series about designing gadgets, designing microwave cookers, designing mobile phones like this. And I, as a mathematician, have moaned about these things and said life would be so much better if only designers knew about maths. And quite rightly, people in the audience said, what about humans and users and sort of considering that people actually use these things? So tonight, brought along Dr. Anne Blandford from University College to present the case for users, and we're going to run it as a debate so that we're going to have a motion and I want you to participate and have a view about whether designers ought to know more maths, I'm staking my reputation on that, or whether users and human factors and so on should be taken into account when things are designed. So first of all, can I ask people, what sort of people are you? I assume you've all used stuff. Video recorders, gadgets, telephones, photocopies, and things like that. But how many people here are designers who actually have some... Is one person? Yes? Anybody else who is in the business of making these things? So there are two people who have certainly got to influence. And what are you saying there? We've got a roving microphone if we need it.
So we're now going. So the motion is going to be this hall believes that training in mathematics is more important than training in human factors for designers, the people who make these things. Okay, so before we start the debate, can I have a show of hands for people who believe that we ought to train designers more about maths than human factors? Three, four, five, come on, five, six, seven. Possibly, seven and a half. Shall we see how many people are against the motion? That's practically everybody, isn't it? Sort of, so it's n minus 7.5, isn't it, really? Okay, I'm going to propose the motion and take a couple of slides to do that, and then I'm going to hand over Anne to oppose the motion. The way I'm going to do this is, of course, I've given three lectures beforehand, so I've got an unfair advantage. So I'm just going to summarise my lectures, and I'm going to take it for granted that you believe what I'm saying. The example I'm going to take is redesigning a mobile phone by using mathematics. So mobile phones like this, in one of the previous lectures, I said these are badly designed because they're just thrown together, and in this case, Nokia, haven't used mathematics. How would you use mathematics to design these things a bit better? Well, perhaps one way of doing it is you define a function to map the keystrokes, pressing these buttons, to activate the appropriate functions. That's a mathematical activity. There are various sorts of functions that you could choose. One would be a Huffman function, which we talked about. Another would be to have some weak concession to the user and say, well, we want to have the functions in alphabetical order. And I gave a demonstration of such a system in the last lecture. I then did some experiments with people, and 30 people trying out different tasks on this. The blue bar is how many keystrokes they took on the original Nokia phone, and the shorter bar down here is how many keystrokes they took on the improved phone. So I think my case more or less rests there, that a mathematical design of these things makes them much better than what commercial companies are managing to do with all of their human factors or whatever training. So I suggest you should support the motion. Designers need to learn more maths, and it works. I've just given you some evidence. There you go. Over to Anne, see if she can beat that.
I, of course, kind of have an unfair advantage today, which is that I have slightly longer than Harold to talk. So my starting position is that we really need to understand the human factors, because although if you look around this room, we're clearly all different at some level, but we also have an awful lot in common. And some of those common features go beyond the stuff that's really obvious, like most of us have two eyes and two arms, and some of us wave them around a lot and some of us don't. When we're designing, we can actually design to work with the way that we are or against the way that we are. And it's important to understand us and the way that we function in order to be able to design effectively. And I'm going to start with a kind of double act. Harold's going to help with this bit. This is where we need to play around with the technology for a minute. I need to end the show, because that was just making it a black screen. Wonderful stuff, PowerPoint. And we're going to go for a railway journey. I'm starting in Welwyn North, which is, some of you may be familiar with it, it's kind of a bit outside London, up to the north side. And as it happens, I want to go to New Southgate. I have about me my network card. This allows me to get cheaper journeys. So I am going to go to the ticket machine, this wonderful ticket machine, which I was going to press the buttons on, but I've actually realised I'm not quite tall enough. So we're going to have to imagine that bit. So I need to go, well, it's not there. So I need to press here and magically go to other destinations, because I'm trying to get to New Southgate. And I really can't reach this one. I hope I haven't wrecked the mic with that.
That one. Yep.
Yeah, MN and O, because I need to get there. And I still can't see New Southgate, so I need to go to the next screen. Oh, it's got there. So I then need to press that button up there. And I can't see one that allows me to use my network card. This, so I can get singles, I can get travel cards, I can even get first class fares. There's a blank there, so you'd have thought they might have put it there. But it's not there, but there are more fares. So I'll try that. My wonderful multi-user system here. It's still not there. So obviously I can't buy a ticket with my network card using the machine. I'm going to have to go to the ticket office and use the nice person there. So I've given up. Okay, it's not there. Clearly can't do it. These machines don't do everything. I know that. In fact, if we go back and choose a cheap day return. Up there. Hey, we found a new button, a one we hadn't expected before, which says rail card discounts. And there we have it. Well, I'm not quite sure whether I've got a gold one or an old one, but we'll try the old one. Okay, so now I can buy my ticket. I'll put my money in the slot, because that's the right kind of ticket. It won't let me put it in. I mean, actually, physically, the slot is closed. You cannot put your coins in at that point. Eventually, you realize that there's a thing down here which says purchase ticket. So you try pressing on that. That doesn't work either. So you think, okay, it'll have to be that little thing there. Hey! At last, I can buy my ticket. So now I can try and put my coins in. Hey, grab my ticket, and off I go. Incidentally, I've probably left my change behind at that moment as well. Am I particularly incompetent? Actually, these are all anecdotes from Harold that I strung together as a sequence.
So you're implying I'm incompetent?
I'm implying any of us can be incompetent. Or we can work in ways which are very natural to us, but where the technology is kind of working against us. So if I put that thing to bed, sorry, this is where the technology is getting in the way again. Go back. Wakey, wakey. There we go. Okay, so we've just seen a series of interactions kind of strung together one after the other with that ticket machine. We've actually seen at least three different kinds of mistakes that I made with it. We went and talked to the designers of this particular system, and their account of their expectations of users was that it's a queuebuster system. It doesn't matter that it doesn't do everything. It doesn't matter that people find it hard to use the first time or two or three or four that they work with it. The regular people who commute up and down that line are expected to learn how to use the system and will then be able to work with it very effectively. Just observing people casually, if you kind of hang around on the, you know, in the ticket office and watch people working with these things, you'll see an awful lot of people walking away from them for the kinds of reasons that I've just outlined, or for other ones that, you know, we haven't even thought of yet. People give up quite often and go off to the ticket office, usually muttering horribly under their breath. Even the successful interactions can feel frustrating and unpleasant to the people engaged in them. Did I make all this up? Are these just completely random errors, or can we actually start to make sense of them, learn from them, apply them in other situations? Well, that's what I want to argue, is that what we do is not completely haphazard, that this isn't, you know, just problems with a ticket machine, that these problems generalize to other situations that you can learn from one context and apply that same understanding in other situations. So I'd like to argue that those three mistakes that I made, we can label them. We can call the first one where I decided the thing didn't exist, that function didn't exist. I'll call that an interaction trap. I was trapped into believing that the system doesn't do something which in actual fact it does. The second one where we failed to hit the purchase ticket button down the bottom, I'll call an I've told it all it needs to know error. Because by that point, you've specified everything that you want to say to it, and you just want to put your money in as the kind of confirmation that that's the kind of ticket that you want. And the third one, where I walked off with my ticket, but without my change, I'll call a post-completion error. One where I'd achieved what I set out to do, which was to get my ticket, but forgot to finish off the interaction in some other way. And I want to argue that all of these are caused by the ways that we think and we interact, and that these aren't, you know, problems which are unique to one person or unique to one computer system. So I'll work through them, you know, just a little bit more detail, each of those three problems. So we had the interaction trap. Why? Well, the user started off assuming that they could buy one of these tickets, and then because of the way the interaction with the ticket machine progressed, they came to believe that they couldn't do it. Because there were two obvious places in that interaction where they might have expected to find that option, and it just wasn't there. So we can imagine whoever designs these things redesigning the interface and the underlying interaction that's going on in order to make that option much more accessible. Sounds obvious when you say it like that. What about the second error, where I thought I told it everything it needed to know? User didn't realize that he or she needed to press the purchase ticket button. Because if I insert the money, that says the same thing without making it explicit. When we talk to each other, we don't tend to make things explicit unless we're talking to a small child and worrying about their comprehension. We don't tend to do that. Apparently, it's designed like it is because it's a security feature, that they want people to definitely confirm that this is the right ticket before they enter their money or their credit card. But I think, you know, there's actually a real question about that. I don't know for sure that it would be better designed without. But it seems to me that the number of people who give up at that point, and we have actually seen quite a lot of people just walking away from it then going, stupid system. What's the cost of that problem as against the cost of the probably relatively small number of people who might end up buying a ticket that they didn't actually mean to? I think there's a question there. Finally, the post-completion error, the forgetting the change. Why do people forget their change on stations? Well, they're in a rush. The train's just pulled in at the platform. A person's calling out the announcements. You need to be at platform 6 now. You're rushed, you're distracted, you're trying to make sure you don't forget your bags. The environment's a bit noisy. As soon as you've got your ticket, there's a tendency to want to get to platform 7 and not miss your train. Why is it designed like that? Well, apparently it's designed like that because the designers preferred the customers to forget their change than to forget the second half of the ticket because it comes out in two pieces. Could it be designed better? Well, we can probably think of several ways it could be designed better. For instance, you might have a single ticket that gets you both ways. It might deliver the tickets and the change at the same time instead of delivering the tickets first and then kind of the change appearing a few seconds later. There are probably other options, but you need to start to understand the problem before you can think about how you can design it better. And as I've said, I want to argue that these aren't one-offs, that we can see the same kinds of errors arising in a variety of situations. So I'll start with the last one, the post-completion error. I want to argue that when you leave your bank card in the automatic teller machine, actually we don't do this now, but like 15, 20 years ago when those holes in the wall first appeared, there was a huge problem of people taking their money and walking away, leaving their cards still in the machine. They've been redesigned since to try to avoid this particular problem. Forgetting to lock the keypad. So I want to make a call. So my keypad's always locked because I don't want to dial people by mistake. So embarrassing, isn't it? So to phone anybody, I need to unlock the keypad first and then do all the dialing stuff. And then I've finished, end call, forget to relock it. Anybody else do that ever? Or is it just me? Yeah. Good. Leaving the original on the photocopier when you go away. You know, you go to make some copies. You've got 25 copies. They're all double-sided, stapled in the corner. Wonderful, you've done a great job. And your original's still left. The last page of the original's still left there on the glass. Forgetting to reset high security on a till. If you actually look in supermarkets, they've usually got it chained to their belt so they can't leave it behind. There are lots of different situations that I would like to argue are the same problems with the way that we think and we work. They're all characterized by what I'll call a trailing sub-goal. What do I mean? What I mean is that very early on, you have to do something to kind of mess up the state. You need to put your card in the ATM to identify yourself. You need to unlock the mobile phone. You need to place the original on the photocopier. You need to enter a username and password or similar. Then do what you need to do, then reset it. So you've achieved what you set out to do, but there's this silly little thing that you still need to do at the end that isn't important to you, isn't what what is key about your interaction with that system. And so you forget about it. Anybody else think of more examples of this kind of thing? Anything else where you do what you want to do and there's a little bit left over at the end?
Locking your keys in your car.
So locking your keys in your car.
Oh. I get out. Umbrellas on the train.
You don't? Yeah. Yesterday when I got into London, the guy has, whoever does the announcements on the train actually said as we came into Euston, don't forget to take all your belongings with you, and that includes your umbrellas. So one guesses that umbrellas must be a huge problem on trains.
Leaving the other one on
after you've got your meal nice and ready, because that's really what you want to do is go and eat it, isn't it? So we can think of lots and lots of examples. I had more, but you've come up with enough. So a lot of you clearly identify with the phenomenon. So if we think about this, you know, we've understand the phenomenon. How can we actually think about new design solutions that help us to get away from that, to get away from the problem? Well, actually, it turns out that it's not always easy. Oh, somebody forgot to turn their phone off. It's not always easy to find, you know, there's no unique solution to it. But once you start to understand it, I would argue from a human factors perspective, you can start to identify common patterns of ways to start to fix these problems. So I've already said, with the ATM, you can change the task structure. So ATMs in this country now, though maybe not in America, I believe, sometimes, they always make you take your card out before they'll give you your money, for reasons I've already explained. Maybe with the ticket machine, you can make it return the change with or before it gives you the ticket. So you can change the structure of the interaction so that it works for people, so that their main goal is the last thing that they achieve. Don't think that would work with the oven and eating your dinner, but it can work in many situations. Another design solution that's been shown to work in some situations is explicitly drawing the user's attention to the perturbation, to the thing that's gone wrong. It, delivering coins noisily. I'd love it if my phone flashed or beeped at me when I finished a call and I've forgotten to relock it. But it doesn't. A lot of modern photocopiers actually eject the original so that it comes back to somewhere where you can see it and it's no longer kind of just sitting there on the glass. And that draws your attention to it and you're less likely to forget it. As I said, in the supermarket, very often the keys that supervisors have are on a chain so that they can't leave it in the lock and walk away. So there are a range of different solutions that all involve basically drawing the user's attention to the fact that they've got to finish off the task. There's other ones like making the computer system responsible for finishing off the task for the user, which is sometimes possible, but not very often, actually. So just to summarise what I'm saying about post-completion errors, which are just one particular kind of error, they're occasional. We don't make these mistakes every time. You know, I don't forget to lock my phone every time I make a call. But they just happen occasionally. And they're persistent. You can't train people not to make these mistakes. And what I want to say we're doing here is we've characterised a problem. We've understood a kind of problem that crops up in lots and lots of different situations. And we've outlined a set of solutions that we could apply with our human factors expertise. You know, there's a limited set of solutions which can apply in lots and lots of different situations and hopefully cut down on the problem of post-completion errors. We can follow the same line of reasoning for other kinds of errors, I think. So we made three mistakes when we were working with that ticket machine. We've talked about the post-completion error. I'll go through the other two a little bit more briefly because I want us to have time to talk. The interaction traps and the I told it what it needs to know kind of error. So an interaction trap I've defined as being that situation where the user comes to believe that something is achievable that actually isn't, or that isn't achievable that actually is. Of course, if they believe something's achievable but it's actually not, then they end up with a kind of futile and frustrating phase of interaction where, you know, they can't understand why they can't do it and eventually they're going to give up because it's simply not possible, but they've wasted a lot of time in the process. Conversely, as with the ticket machine example, the user comes to believe that it's not possible to do something and so they give up, go away and actually haven't achieved what they set out to do. Of course, where people actually start to make the mistake can happen much, much earlier in the interaction. It might even happen before they start interacting with this this device or this computer system. So, I guess, I think I've already said this, they had a goal, which was to buy a ticket with a network card. Because it's not in the obvious places, they come to believe that the machine doesn't provide that option because it's not where they would expect it to be. There's lots of places it could have been, and it wasn't there. The user eventually gives up and goes to the ticket collector. There's a mismatch because the user has a reasonable expectation about where in the interaction they would have found this option and the possibilities that are actually made available by the ticket machine. I even suffered a kind of interaction trap when I was mucking around with the Gresham website a week ago, when I was trying to remember what the little abstract for tonight's talk said. So I thought, right, I'll go and find it under events. So in order to do this, we need to click on the word events. And you see, we can find out about all events from the day I did this, which was actually the 4th, up till the end of December. Well, that's an awful lot of events. I don't want that many, actually. So I'll change it to being the end of April. So I need to change this 12 here. I'm not actually doing it for real. Whereas with the ticket machine, I was working with a real simulation. Here, I'm just working with PowerPoint. I've lost my mouse. Yeah, so I'll change that to be the end of April. And then I'll submit. Now, again, I've lost my mouse, but you press the submit button, get an error message. This date is not valid. 04/31/2003. I'm thinking, oops, I've put it in an American format. It's backwards. So I better go and fix that. So I go to that one and discover, well, it only goes up to the number 12. So that must be the month option. Check the other one, it goes 1 up to 31, so that has to be the date option. So I try again, because I'm persistent in my error making, and I get the same error again. What's the problem? There's only 30 days. You're obviously faster than me. You change it to being 30 days, and it all works absolutely fine. But it took me, you're slightly... educationally subnormal lecturer, two attempts, I mean, yeah, this is actually a real interaction, to work out that I'd got caught in a trap because there was this mismatch in representation that I was thinking of it as the end of the month and didn't think, but there's only 30 days in April. And that's not the same as the 30th of the month, which is the way that the computer system was represented in it. Can any of you think of any traps of these kinds? It's amazing. Once I started thinking about traps, I discovered I was falling into them all over the place. It was really scary. Sorry, at the back. Cheap flights on the internet. And you set out believing it's going to be easy. I'll be able to book them, no problem. And you head off down this long... tortuous interaction, and yeah, it fails in some way. Similar kind of thing. Anybody else?
My computer's virus protection. I found a couple of days ago. It said you must review this in 30 days. Fine, let's carry on. And I followed the instructions to the best of my knowledge. It said, "Are you UK or United States?" UK. Three times over, all the subsequent stuff refers to the United States.
Wonderful, isn't it? Yeah, so you reach a point where you conclude you can't do it, presumably.
Well, I've discovered that there is a phone number which I plan to ring up.
Yeah, sorry.
If you're using search engines, I think it's deliberately made more difficult now to get into a more efficient search engine. You start with Microsoft, which isn't very good, and try to get to something like Google. And they try and, you know, booby trap to make sure you can't. You search for Google and they give all the relevant stuff about Google instead of connecting to the web device, which is what you want, of course. So one can literally make some difference.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. So that's almost getting at the other side of the problem, that perhaps designers sometimes want to design to fool or mislead users and can do that actually quite intentionally. I suspect that might be the problem with some of the cheap flights options as well, just like it is with the search engine. Sorry, did everybody hear the example from the front here? No. Gentleman said that some of the search engines now are designed such that it's really hard to find a more efficient or more effective search engine, that you're kind of stuck with the proprietary one belonging to a particular manufacturer. So that's almost intentionally creating a trap for people to stop them getting out and using perhaps more desirable products. Okay, so again, we've had two or three. Probably a few more of you can think of them in your heads and aren't actually talking about them. But as you go about your daily lives in the next few days, you'll probably find you're spotting more and more of these. Sorry. So again, we can think about why are they happening and how do we design solutions that presumably help us to avoid falling into these traps, unless it's the Machiavellian design. If we try to anticipate, what are the likely user goals? You know, whoever designed the ticket machine had clearly thought that people would want to buy tickets with it and that perhaps they might have discount cards. If those are the kinds of goals that they're trying to serve, then why don't they make those things accessible to the users? If there are things where the user might start to misunderstand what state the computer system is in, then how about making the state it's in more visible on the screen to the user? Very often these things happen because there's something the user needs to know that's hidden from them. Giving clearer feedback on the effects of your actions. You know, just saying it's not a valid date isn't actually particularly helpful. You could contextualize that, like, remember some months only have 28 or 30 days. Of course, I'm doing this with the wisdom of hindsight. Arguably, a lot of these problems could be anticipated ahead of time. Even if some of them can't, once you've identified them, you can go in and correct them. And part of that is about understanding us, about how we acquire goals, how we choose what to do, how we track the state of the computer system relative to where we are and how we're making progress towards our goals. And with that kind of understanding, you can start to develop design solutions that'll work better. And finally, again, I'm taking too long over it, I've told it what it needs to know. Okay, so on the ticket machine, it was the problem about pressing the purchase ticket option. Because there's this additional confirmatory step in the interaction that the user doesn't expect and may forget, we thought of lots of other examples, like programming your VCR. You know, it takes ages on lots of VCRs to get all the timing information in there and set it all up to be long play and channel 4 or whatever. And then it's so easy to forget that hit that put it into record mode button. Can see people nodding. My solution is to find a teenager to do it for me. That works normally. Harold had a problem with his Fluke multimeter where it was measuring DC rather than AC and or vice versa. And again, to him it was very obvious what state it should be in. My spelling corrector on my word processor does it to me all the time. Sorry, this one's not very clear, is it? Basically, if you're trying to add something to the autocorrector. So, you know, I'm forever typing design and spelling it Desjin. And rather than me having to go back and correct it every time, I thought I'd put it into the autocorrector so every time I type Desjin, it'll autocorrect it for me to design. So I typed it in here, replace Desjin with design, and then that's the only one I want to do, so I hit OK. And I haven't hit the add button, and it doesn't do it. And the next time I want to spell it Desjin, it sticks as being Desjin again. And I wonder why, because I've added it, haven't I? So it's because you have to explicitly add before you click the OK button. And you'd have thought it was obvious, wouldn't you? Microsoft Word. Autocorrect feature. go and look for it. So yet again, we can think of design solutions like eliminating the unnecessary step. I'd have thought it was obvious if I've gone to the effort of typing a word there, and click the end button or the OK button, that it would have been obvious that that's really what I wanted it to do. Make the defaults on the system sensible ones so that you don't have to every time set it to what seems to you to be obvious. Make it clearer what, when things are checking, what kind of mess. You know, I don't understand my own slide. I understood it an hour ago. What did I mean by that? Oh, adding messages. So if the system's not sure whether you really intended to put your VCR into record mode or not, you know, enable it to create a little message that says, do you want to put it into this mode or not now? You know, maybe you don't. Again, more clearly communicating what state the system is in so that it's obvious that it's not in record mode or in DC rather than AC or vice versa or whatever, so that the user is much more aware of the fact that they need to tell it something more. Again, we can probably, lots of us, think of examples of these kinds of errors. No, is this one a bit harder? I finished. Why do I need to tell it to do this and that as separate activities?
Because one is when, I mean, most Windows programs, especially Word, when you quit it, you need to save first. It should save by default. If you don't want to save that, you could revert it. Why would you spend half an hour typing there to save it?
And word processors, why would you spend an hour typing something if you don't want to save it? When you quit, shouldn't it save automatically, was the suggestion here. So again, we can think of lots of examples, well, two or three anyway, where, you know, there's something that's really obvious that you don't feel that you have to make it explicit, and yet the systems are forcing you to, and you make all kinds of errors. You miss that wonderful program on BBC Three or whatever. If you forget to do it. I've literally there just taken the examples that arose from that ticket machine. I've started with the ticket machine as opposed to going, oh, what are all the problems we could have? And I've illustrated for those three kinds of problems that there are lots of other situations in which the same problems arise, and that if we start to understand us and the way we work, then we can understand where we make those mistakes. There are lots of others, actually. I mean, I've just put up three here. So capture errors, where you follow a common sequence, but the situation isn't quite the same today, and therefore you do it wrong. So, you know, if somebody's in a hire car, you know that they drive another kind of car normally when they start indicating with the windscreen wipers. Am I the only person here that's ever done that? You know, that's a very simple example of the kind of thing where you're used to doing things a particular way, and suddenly you're working with a machine that operates very slightly differently, or you're doing a task that's very slightly different, and you do it the way you always do. So, you know, another common example is electronic mail, attaching documents to electronic mail. You know, all those messages that lots of people get where they say, I've attached this document, it says this, that, and the other. Enjoy reading it. And then 5 minutes later you get another message going, oops, I forgot, didn't I? Here it is. Again, you know, most of the time that we're working with email systems, we're not sending attachments. So you compose the message and you hit the send button. It's kind of habit. And so you forget to actually do the attaching on those relatively rare occasions that that's what you're trying to do. Blind alleys, situations where, as a user, you can't know everything that you need to know. You don't have the information you need to make an informed choice. Trivial examples like, you know, phoning somebody up and they're not there. doesn't feel very big, but if you've had to go through switchboards and three of those little menu things where, you know, press one to do this, press two to do that, then if you can't actually achieve what you were trying to do at the end, it gets very frustrating. And if you get the information earlier, then it's a much less frustrating interaction. We often have little detours in our interactions where there's a bit of interaction that you really didn't need to go through because you didn't know enough about how the system works at the beginning to realise that that was completely a waste of time. And so on and so on. So what I want to argue is that while users, and that means all of us, aren't completely predictable, there are lots of common patterns of interaction that are due to the way that our minds work and the ways that we naturally interact with systems. We all make human errors that in principle can be designed out. Some of those can be predicted before, ahead of time, if designers have appropriate human factors expertise. Others perhaps need to be spotted, understood, and then corrected retrospectively. But you can only correct them in appropriate ways if you understand enough about people. So I argue that understanding human factors is essential, more essential than maths, for designing interactions. If you don't understand your users, however logically perfect your system is, it won't actually be usable and useful to those users. So vote against the motion, please, because users are central to interaction design across a broad range of design issues.
For all information, please go to our website at www.gresham.ac.uk.